idea in her head, and then once the creaking started she might unconsciously have guided the search. She couldn't have made those knocks. I felt them.
That, I must admit, I can't explain, except to suppose that your first idea was right, that it was mice or beetles or some other creature, the sound of it getting magnified somehow by the hollowness of the walls. As for the trapped bird, I lowered my voice, well, I imagine it's already crossed your mind that your mother might have imagined that whole incident.
Yes, it has, she answered, speaking quietly too. She hadn't been sleeping. But then again, according to her, it was the bird that was keeping her awake. And Betty also heard the sound, don't forget.
I said, I think Betty, in the middle of the night, would hear just about any sound suggested to her. These things have a circularity to them. Something woke your mother, I don't doubt that, but then her very sleeplessness may have kept her awake, or kept her dreaming she was awake. And after that her mind was vulnerable in some way.
I think it's vulnerable now, she said.
What do you mean? She hesitated.
I'm not sure. She seems changed.
I said, changed?
How?
But I think a note of weariness was creeping into my tone, for it seemed to me that she and I had had this conversation, or others very like it, several times before. She turned away from me, clearly disappointed, and said,
Oh, I don't know. I'm imagining things, I expect.
She wouldn't say any more. I watched her, with a disappointment of my own. I said I would go up and see her mother, and I took my bag and climbed the stairs. I did it with a slight sense of foreboding, expecting from Caroline's manner to find Mrs. Ayres looking really ill, perhaps back in her bed. But when I knocked on her door, I heard her call out brightly for me to enter. I went in and found the room with its curtains almost closed, but in stark contrast with a little parlour, with two or three lamps lit and a good fire in the grate. The smell was of camphor, maiden auntish. The dressing-room door was wide open, and the bed was heaped with gowns and furs, and with the loose silk bags, like deflated bladders, in which the furs had been stored. Mrs. Ayres looked up from them as I went in, seeming perfectly happy to see me. She and Betty, she told me, were looking through some of her old clothes. She didn't ask after my trip, nor did she show any consciousness of the fact that I had just been downstairs alone with her daughter. She moved forward to take my hand, then led me back towards the bed, nodding to the tangle of gowns upon it.
"I feel so guilty," she said, "with the war on, hanging on to all this. I gave away what I could, but some of these, oh, I just couldn't see them go, to be hacked about and so on, made into blankets for refugees and goodness knows what. Now I'm awfully glad I kept them. Do you think it very wicked of me?"
I smiled, pleased to see her looking so well, so like her old self. Her hair still startled me by its greyness, but she had dressed it with extra care, though in a curiously pre-war style, rather looped about the ears. Her lips had a genteel touch of lipstick, her fingernails were a polished pink, and the skin of her heart-shaped face seemed almost unlined. I turned to the heap of old-fashioned silks. It's certainly difficult to imagine these being handed round in a refugee camp.
Isn't it? Far better to keep them here, where they'll be appreciated.
She picked up a flimsy satin gown with a flapperish droop to its shoulders and skirt. She held it up to show Betty, who was just emerging from the dressing-room with a shoe-box in her hand.
"What do you say to this one, Betty?"
The girl caught my eye, and I gave her a nod. "Hello, Betty. All right?"
"Hello, sir."
Her face was pink. She seemed excited. She was clearly trying to hold the excitement in, but as she looked at the dress her plump little mouth broke into a smile.
"It's lovely, madam."
Things were made to last in those days, and such colours. One simply doesn't see them now. And what have you there?
Slippers, madam. Goldens.
Let me look.
Mrs. Ayres took the box and put back the lid and then the paper inside it.
Ah, now these cost the devil, and they pinched like the devil too, as I remember. I only wore them once.
She held them up. Then she said, as if on impulse,
You try them, Betty.
Oh, madam.
Betty blushed, glancing self-consciously at me.
Shall I?
Yes, go on. Show the doctor and me.
So the girl unlaced her stout black shoes and shyly slipped on the gold leather slippers. Then, encouraged by Mrs. Ayres, she walked from the dressing-room door to the fireplace and back again, like a mannequin. She burst out laughing as she did it, raising a hand to cover up her crooked teeth. Mrs. Ayres laughed, too, and when Betty stumbled because the slippers were too big, she stuffed the toes of them with stockings to make them fit. She spent several minutes doing that, and then she dressed the girl with gloves and a stole, and had her stand and walk and turn, lightly applauding as she did it. I thought again of the patient I had put off in order to come out here, but after another minute or two, Mrs. Ayres seemed suddenly to tire.
"There," she said to Betty, sighing, looking over the cluttered bed. "You had better tidy these things away, or I shall have nowhere to sleep tonight."
"You're sleeping well, though?" I asked, as she and I moved over to the fire. And then, seeing Betty disappearing into the dressing-room with an armful of furs, I said quietly, "I hope you don't mind, but Caroline told me about your discovery last week. I gather it quite unsettled you." She was bending forward to pick up a cushion. She said,
"It did, rather. Wasn't that foolish of me?"
"Not foolish at all."
"After so much time," she murmured, sitting back,
lifting her face and surprising me with her expression, which showed no trace of worry or anguish, but on the contrary was almost serene.
"I didn't suppose there was any trace of her left, you see."
She placed her hand above her heart.
"Except in here. She has always been real to me, in here. More real, sometimes, than anything else."
She kept her hand upon her breast, lightly smoothing the fabric of her gown. Her look had grown vague, inward-looking. But then a certain amount of vagueness was habitual with her, and part of her charm. Nothing about her behaviour struck me as odd or made me anxious. I thought she seemed pretty healthy and content. I spent about 15 minutes with her, then headed back downstairs. Caroline was where I had left her, standing limply at the hearth. The fire was low in the grate. The light was dimmer than ever, and again I was conscious of the great contrast between the cheerlessness of this room and the cosiness of her mother's, and again the sight of her, with her housemaid's hands, unreasonably annoyed me.
"Well?"
she asked me, looking up. I said, "I think you're worrying about nothing."
"What's my mother doing?"
"She's been going through some old clothes with Betty."
"Yes, that's all she wants to do now, things like that. Yesterday she brought out those photographs again, the ones that were spoiled, you remember?"
I spread my hands. "She's entitled to look at photographs, isn't she? Can you blame her for wanting to think about the past, when her present is so joyless?"
"It isn't just that."
"What is it, then?"
"It's something in her manner. She isn't just thinking about the past. It's as though, when she looks at you, she isn't really seeing you at all. She's seeing something else. And she tires so easily. She isn't at all old, you know, but she takes a rest now, like an old lady, nearly every afternoon. She never mentions Roderick. She's not interested in Dr. Warren's reports. She doesn't want to see anybody. Oh, I can't explain it."
I said, "She's had a jolt, coming across those scribbles, being reminded again of your sister. It's bound to have shaken her up." I realized, as I said the words, that she and I had never spoken about Susan, the lost little girl. The same thing must have occurred to her. She stood in silence, raising her dirty fingers to her mouth, and starting to pick and pull at her lip. And when she spoke again, her voice had changed. She said,
"It's queer to hear you say your sister like that. It doesn't sound right. Mother never mentioned her, you see, when Rod and I were children. I knew nothing about her for years and years. Then one day I came across a book with Suki Ayres written in it, and asked Mother who she was. She reacted so oddly I was frightened. That's when Daddy told me all about it. He called it awfully bad luck. But I don't remember being sorry for him or for Mother. I just remember being cross, because everyone had always told me I was the eldest child, and I thought it wasn't fair if I hadn't been, really."
She gazed down at the fire, her forehead creasing.
"I seem to have been cross all the time, somehow, when I was a girl. I was horrid to Roddy. I was horrid to the maids. You're supposed to grow out of horridness, aren't you? I don't think I ever grew out of mine. Sometimes I think it's still inside me, like something nasty I swallowed that got stuck."
She did, at that moment, look rather like a moody child, with her dirty hands and a couple of locks of unbrushed brown hair beginning to droop across her face. Like other bad-tempered children, however, she also looked desperately sad. I made a half-movement towards her. She lifted her head as I did it and must have caught my hesitation. And at once the air of childishness fell away. She said, in a hard society tone,
"I haven't asked after your trip to London, have I? How did it go?"
I said, "Thank you, it went well."
"You spoke at the conference?"
"Yes, I did."
"Did people like what you said?"
"Very much. In fact—" I hesitated again. "Well, there's been some talk of my going back down there. Going down there to work, I mean." Her gaze changed, seemed to quicken.
"There has? Do you mean to do it?"
"I don't know. I should have to think about it, about what I was giving up."
"And that's why you've been keeping away from us? You haven't wanted the distraction? I saw your car in park on Saturday. I thought you might be going to call in. Then, when you didn't, I guessed that something must have happened, that something must have changed. That's why I called you up today, because I couldn't count on your coming out here in the ordinary way, the way you used to, I mean."
She tucked back the drooping hair.
"Did you ever mean to visit us again?"
"Of course I did."
"But you have been keeping away, haven't you?"
She tilted up her chin as she asked this. That was all she did. But like stubborn milk finally yielding to the motion of the churn, the anger shifted inside me and became something else, something quite different. My heart began to beat faster. I said after a moment, "I've been a little afraid, I think."
"Afraid of what? Of me?"
"Hardly."
"Of my mother?"
I took a breath. "Listen, Caroline, that time in the car—"
"Oh, then," she turned her head, "I behaved like a fool."
"I was the fool. I'm sorry."
"And now everything's changed and wrong. No, please don't."
For she looked so unhappy I'd gone across and started to embrace her. And though she stood rigid and resisting for a moment or two, when she realized I meant to do nothing more than put my arms around her, she slightly relaxed. The last time I had held her like this had been to dance with her. She had been in heels, her eyes and mouth on a level with mine. Now her shoes were flat ones, and she was an inch or two shorter. I moved my chin, and the stubble of it caught at her hair. She bent her head, her cool, dry brow sliding into the hollow beneath my ear. And then, somehow, she was standing full against me. I felt the push and yield of her breasts, the pressure of her hips and heavy thighs. I moved my hands across her back and drew her to me more tightly still.
"Don't,"
she said again. She said it pretty weakly, though. And the surge of my feelings astonished me. A few moments before I had looked at her and felt nothing but exasperation and annoyance. Now I said her name, speaking breathily into her hair, moving my cheek roughly against her head.
"I've missed you, Caroline," I said. "God, I've missed you like hell."
I wiped my mouth unsteadily.
"Look at me. Look what a bloody idiot you've made of me."
She began to pull away.
"I'm sorry."
I gripped her harder.
"Don't be sorry, for God's sake," she said miserably.
"I've missed you too. Whenever you go away, something happens here. Why is that? This house and my mother."
She closed her eyes, put her hand to her forehead as if against a bad headache.
"This house makes one think things."
"This house is too much for you."
"I've been almost afraid."
"There's nothing to be afraid of. I shouldn't have left you, to be cooped up here on your own."
I wish I could get away. I can't, with mother."
"Don't think about your mother. Don't think about going away. You don't need to go away." And neither did I thought. For everything seemed clear to me suddenly, there with Caroline in my arms. My plans, the consultant, the London hospital, all of it melted away. "I've been a fool," I said. "Everything we need is right here. Think about that, Caroline. Think about me. About us."
"No, someone might come."
I had started to nudge at her mouth with mine, but now we swayed and, in swaying, moved our feet to find our balance and somehow separated. She took a step out of my reach, putting up one of her filthy hands. Her hair was untidier than ever from the rub of my cheek. Her lips were parted, faintly damp. She looked like a woman who'd just been kissed, and who, to be honest, wanted to be kissed again. But when I moved towards her, she took a second step back, and I saw then that her desire had another quality mixed up with it—innocence, or something stronger. Reluctance. A touch even of fear. So I didn't try to embrace her again. I didn't trust myself to do it without frightening her away. Instead, I caught hold of one of her hands and lifted it, and touched the dirty knuckles to my lips, and as I gazed at her fingers, rubbing my thumb over the blackened nails, I said with a tremor of desire and daring, "Look what you've done to yourself, you perfect child. There'll be no more of this sort of thing, you know, once we are married." She said nothing. I was briefly aware of the house, as still and as silent around us as if it were holding its breath. Then she slightly bowed her head again, and at that, with a rush of triumph, I did pull her to me, to kiss not her mouth, but her throat, her cheeks, and hair. She gave a burst of nervous laughter. "Wait," she said, half playful, half serious, almost struggling. "Wait! Oh, wait!"
Chapter 10 I think now of the 3 or 4 weeks that followed as Caroline's and my courtship, though the truth is, what passed between us was never so settled, nor so uncomplicated as really to deserve that name. For one thing, I was still very busy, and could rarely get to see her for more than hurried snatches of time. For another, she turned out to be surprisingly squeamish about exposing this definite shift in our relationship to her mother. I was impatient to get things moving, have some sort of announcement made. She felt her mother wasn't well enough yet, that the news would simply make her worry. She would tell her, she assured me, when the moment was right. That moment seemed terribly slow in arriving, however, and as often as not, when I called in at the hall in those weeks, I'd end up sitting with the two women in the little parlour, taking tea and dryly chatting, just as if nothing had really changed. But, of course, everything had changed, and from my point of view those visits were sometimes rather hard to bear. I thought of Caroline constantly now. Looking into her strong, angular face, I couldn't believe that I had ever found it plain. Meeting her eye across the teacups, I felt like a man made of tinder, flaring up at the simple friction of her gaze against mine. Sometimes, when I had said my goodbye, she would walk with me to my car. We'd go in silence through the house, passing room after shadowy room, and I'd think of leading her into one of those wasted chambers and pulling her into my arms. Now and then I chanced it, but she was never at ease. She'd stand against me with her head averted, her arms hanging loosely at her sides. I'd feel the softening and warming of her limbs against mine, but slowly, slowly, as if they begrudged even their own slight yielding. And if ever, frustrated, I pressed further, the result was disaster. Her soft limbs would harden, her hands come up across her face. "I'm sorry," she'd say, just as she had on that chilling occasion in my car. "I'm sorry. It isn't fair of me, I know. I just need a little time." So I learned not to ask too much of her. My great fear now was of pushing her away. I had the sense that, overburdened as she was with Hundred's business, our engagement was simply one complication too many. I supposed she was waiting until things at the hall improved before allowing herself to plan for the time beyond. And at that point, real improvement seemed close at hand. Work on the council houses was progressing. The extending of water and electricity out to the park was underway. Things at the farm, apparently, were looking up, and Makins was pleased with all the changes. Mrs. Ayres, too, despite Caroline's doubts about her, still seemed healthier and happier than she had in months. Every time I called at the house, I found her carefully dressed, with touches of rouge and powder on her face. As usual, in fact, she was far better turned out than her daughter, who, despite the change in our relationship, continued to wear her shapeless old sweaters and skirts, her rough wool hats and stout shoes. But since the weather remained wintry, I felt I could forgive her that. Once the season turned, I planned to take her into Leamington and quietly kit her out with some decent dresses. I thought often and longingly of the summer days to come. The hall with its doors and windows thrown open. Caroline in short sleeves and loose-necked blouses, her long limbs brown, her dusty feet bare. My own cheerless house felt as dim as a stage set to me now. At night I would lie in my bed, weary but wakeful, thinking of Caroline lying in hers. My mind would go softly across the darkened miles between us, to slip like a poacher through the Hundreds gate and along the overgrown drive, to nudge open the swollen front door, to inch across the checkered marble, and then to go creeping, creeping towards her, up the still and silent stairs. Then, one day in early March, I dropped in at the house as usual to find that something had happened. Those mysterious tricks, or parlour games, as Caroline had once dubbed them, had started up again in a new form. She didn't want to tell me about them at first. She said they were too boring to mention. But she and her mother both looked tired, and I happened to comment on it, and then she confessed to me that for the past few nights they had been woken in the early hours of the morning by the ringing of the telephone bell. It had happened 3 or 4 times, she said, always between 2 and 3 o'clock, and every time, when they had gone down to unhook the receiver, the line had been dead. They had wondered at one point if the caller could be me.
"You were the only person we could think of," Caroline said, "who might be up at that sort of time."
She glanced at her mother, colouring slightly.
"It wasn't you, I suppose?"
"No, it wasn't," I replied. "I wouldn't dream of calling so late. And at 2 o'clock this morning, as it happens, I was tucked up in bed. So unless I put through the call in my sleep..."
"Yes, of course," she said, smiling. "There must have been some sort of muddle at the exchange. I just wanted to be sure."
She spoke as if that put an end to the matter, so I let the subject drop. The next time I visited, however, I learned that another call had come, again around 2:30, a night or two before. Caroline had left the telephone to ring this time, lying in bed, unwilling to get up in the cold and the darkness. But at last its hard, hectic clamour had been too much to ignore, and hearing her mother stirring in her room, she had gone down and picked up the receiver, only to find that, as usual, the line was dead.
"At least, no," she corrected herself. "It wasn't dead. That's the funny thing. There was no voice, but I thought... Oh, it sounds silly, but I could have sworn there was someone there. Someone who'd rung particularly for Hundreds, particularly for us. Again, you see, I thought of you."
"And once again," I said, "I was fast asleep and dreaming. And since we were on our own this time," I added, "dreaming of you, very probably." I put up my hand to her hair. She caught my fingers and stilled them.
"Yes, but someone called. And what I've been thinking... I can't get the idea out of my mind, but you don't think it could have been Roddy, do you?"
"Rod," I said, startled. "Oh, surely not."
"It's possible, isn't it? Suppose he's in some sort of trouble, at that clinic, I mean. We haven't seen him for so long. Dr. Warren just says the same thing every time he writes. They could be doing anything to him, trying any sort of medicine or treatment. We don't know what they're doing, really. We just pay the bills."
I took both her hands in mine. She saw my face and said,
"It's only this feeling I had, that someone had rung up, well, with something to tell us."
"It was 2:30 in the morning, Caroline. Anybody would feel like that. It must be just what you thought last time. There must have been a mix-up in the lines. In fact, why don't you ring the exchange right now and talk to the girl, explain what's happened?"
"Do you think I should?"
"If it will set your mind at rest, why not?" So... frowning, she went over to the old-fashioned little parlour extension and dialed for the operator. She stood with her back to me as she did it, but I listened to her running through the story of the calls.
"Yes, if you wouldn't mind,"
I heard her say, her voice artificially bright, and then a moment later, with some of the brightness gone,
"I see. Yes, I expect you're right. Yes, thank you. I'm sorry to have troubled you."
She set down the telephone and its earpiece and turned back to me, her frown deeper than ever. Raising her fingers to her mouth to bite at the tips of them, she said,
"The woman who works the night shift isn't there now, of course, but the girl I spoke to looked at the tickets, their log or whatever, where they keep a record of the calls. She said no one telephoned Hundreds this week. No one at all. She said no one called last week either."
"Then," I said after a moment, "that puts the whole thing beyond doubt. There's clearly a fault with the line, or, more probably, with the wiring in this house. It wasn't Rod at all. You see, it wasn't anyone."
"Yes,"
she said slowly, still nibbling at her fingers.
"That's what the girl said. Yes, it must be that, mustn't it?"
She spoke as if wanting to be convinced. But the telephone rang again that night, and because when I next saw her, she was still irrationally troubled by the idea that her brother might be trying to contact her, to put her mind completely at rest, I called up the Birmingham clinic to ask if there was any possibility of Rod's having made the calls. I was assured that there was not. It was Dr. Warren's assistant I spoke to, and his tone, I noticed, was less breezy than when I had seen him just before Christmas. He told me that Rod, after seeming to have made some slight but definite progress at the start of the year, had recently disappointed them all by having a bad couple of weeks. He didn't go into details, but, like a fool, I made this call with Caroline at my side. She caught enough of the conversation to realize that the news was not good, and after that she was more subdued and preoccupied than ever. And as if in response to this shift in her anxieties, the telephone calls ceased, and a fresh set of nuisances took over. This time I was there the day they began, having dropped in between cases. Caroline and I were again alone together in the little parlour. In fact, I had been kissing her goodbye, and she had just stepped out of my arms, when the door opened, surprising us both. Betty came in, made a curtsy, and asked, "What was wanted of her?" "What do you mean?" asked Caroline, flustered, speaking sharply, brushing back her hair. "The bell rang, miss." "Well, I didn't ring it. It must be my mother who wants you." Betty looked confused. "Madam's upstairs, miss." "Yes, I know she's upstairs. But please, miss, it were the little parlour bell that rung." "Well, it couldn't have been, could it, if I didn't ring it, and neither did Dr. Faraday. Do you think it rang itself? Go on upstairs if my mother wants you."
Blinking, Betty backed away. When the door was closed, I caught Caroline's eye, wiping my mouth and almost laughing, but she wouldn't return my smile. She turned away as if impatient, and she said with surprising force,
"Oh, this is hateful. I can't bear it, all this slinking around like cats."
"Like cats?" I said, amused by the image. I reached for her hand to pull her back. "Come here, puss. Nice puss."
"Stop it, for heaven's sake. Betty might come."
"Well, Betty's a country girl. She knows about the birds and the bees, and the cats. Besides, you know the solution, don't you? Marry me. Next week. Tomorrow. Whenever you like. Then I can kiss you, and to hell with who sees, and little Betty will be busier than ever bringing us our eggs and bacon in bed in the morning and nice things like that." I was still smiling, but she turned back to me with an odd expression. She said,
"But what do you mean? We wouldn't be here, would we?"
We had never discussed the practical side of the life we would have together, married. I had taken it for granted that I would live with her there at the Hall. I said, less certainly than before, "Well, why not? We couldn't leave your mother, could we?" She was frowning.
"But how would it work, with your patients? I'd assumed..."
I smiled. "You wouldn't rather live with me in Lidcourt, in that dreadful old house of Gill's?"
"No, of course not."
"Well, we can sort something out. I'll keep the surgery going in the village, perhaps start up some night system with Graham. I don't know. Everything will change anyway in July, when the health service comes in."
"But when you came back from London," she said, "you told me there might be a post for you there."
She took me by surprise. I'd forgotten all about it. My trip to London felt an age away now. The affair with her had put the whole thing out of my head. I said carelessly, "Oh, there's no point thinking about it now. July will change everything. There might be posts galore after that. Or posts for no one."
"For no one? But then how would we ever leave?"
I blinked. "Would we want to leave?"
"I thought," she began,
and she looked so anxious I reached for her hand again, saying, "Look, don't worry. There'll be plenty of time for all this sort of thing once we're married. That's the main thing, isn't it? The thing we want, most of all?" She said that, yes, of course it was. I raised her hand to my mouth to kiss it, then, putting on my hat, I made my way to the front door. And there I saw Betty again. She was coming down the staircase, looking more confused than ever, and slightly sulky, too. Mrs. Ayres, it seemed, was fast asleep in her bedroom, so it couldn't possibly have been she who had rung for a maid. But then, Betty told me, she had never supposed that it had been. It was the little parlour bell that had rung. She would swear to it on her own mother's life. And if Miss Caroline and I didn't believe it, well, it wasn't fair to have her word doubted like that.
Her voice rose as she spoke, and soon Caroline appeared, wondering what the commotion was. Glad to escape, I left them arguing together and thought nothing more of it. By the time I returned at the end of that week, however, the hall was, in Caroline's words, a madhouse. The call bells had developed a mysterious life of their own, ringing out at all sorts of hours, so that Betty and poor Mrs. Baisley were continually traipsing from room to room, asking what was wanted of them, sending Caroline and her mother to distraction. Caroline had examined the junction box of bells and wires down in the basement, and could find nothing wrong with it.
"It's as though an imp gets in there," she told me, taking me down to the vaulted passage, "and plays on the wires to torment us. It isn't mice or rats, either. We've put down trap after trap and caught nothing."
I looked at the box in question. That imperious device, as I had once thought of it, to which wires ran, like the nerves of the house, through tubes and channels from the rooms above. I knew from experience that the wires were not especially sensitive things, and that sometimes one had to tug at a lever quite vigorously in order to set a bell ringing. So Caroline's story rather bemused me. She brought me a lamp and a screwdriver, and I poked around at the workings for a while, but the mechanism was very simple. None of the wires was over-taut, and like Caroline herself, I could find no fault. I could only, with some unease, recall those creaks or raps that the women had heard a few weeks before. I thought, too, of the sagging saloon ceiling, the spreading damp, the bulging brickwork. I said nothing about it to Caroline, but it seemed pretty clear to me that the hall had reached a point of dilapidation where one defect was almost setting off another, and I felt more dismayed and frustrated by the house's decline than ever. Meanwhile, the call bells continued their restless, maddening activity, until finally, sick and tired of the whole thing, Caroline took a pair of wire snippers and put the junction box out of use. After that, whenever she or her mother wanted Betty, they had to go to the head of the service staircase and shout for her. Often they'd simply carry on down to the kitchen and see to the chore themselves, just as if they had no servants at all. But the house, it seemed, would not be so easily subdued. And before another week had passed, a new trouble had emerged. The problem this time lay with a relic of the hall's Victorian years, an old speaking tube which had been installed in the 1880s to allow the nursery staff to communicate with the cook, and which ran right down through the house from the day nursery on the second floor to finish at a small ivory mouthpiece in the kitchen. The mouthpiece was stoppered by a whistle, fastened to it by a slim brass chain, and designed to sound when the tube was blown into at the other end. Naturally, with Caroline and Roderick both grown up, it was a very long time since the speaking tube had last been put to serious use. The nurseries themselves had been stripped of their fittings at the start of the war, so that the rooms could be occupied by the officers of the army unit that had been billeted with Mrs. Ayres. Altogether, in fact, the tube must have lain there, mute and dusty and undisturbed, for 15 years. Now, however, Mrs. Baisley and Betty went to Caroline to complain that the disused mouthpiece had started giving off eerie little whistles. I had the whole story from Mrs. Baisley herself when I went down to the kitchen a day or two later to see what the trouble was. She said that, at first, they'd heard the whistling and couldn't imagine what was making it. It had been faint, then.
"Faint," she said, "and gusty, all blow. Well, just like the sound of a kettle working himself up to a boil."
And they concluded doubtfully that it must be the hiss of air escaping from the central heating pipes. But one morning the whistle had sounded so clearly there could be no mistaking the source of it. Mrs. Baisley had been on her own in the kitchen at the time, putting loaves into the oven, and the sudden piercing blast had so startled her she'd burnt her wrist. She didn't, she told me as she showed me the blister, even know what the speaking tube was. She hadn't been at Hundreds long enough ever to have seen the contraption in use. She'd always thought the tarnished mouthpiece and whistle part of the electrics. It had taken Betty to work the thing out and explain it to her, and so when, a day later, the whistle sounded shrilly again, Mrs. Baisley naturally supposed that Caroline or Mrs. Ayres wanted to talk to her from one of the rooms upstairs. She went doubtfully to the mouthpiece, drew out the whistle, and set her ear to the ivory cup. "And what did you hear?" I asked her, following her apprehensive gaze across the kitchen to the now silent tube. She made a face.
"A queer sort of noise."
"Queer? How?"
"I can't say. Like a breath."
"A breath?" I said. "You mean a person breathing? Was there a voice?" No, there wasn't a voice. It was more of a rustling. Then again, not quite a rustling.
"Well, like hearing the operator," she said, "over the telephone. You don't hear her speak, but you know her's listening. You know her's there. Oh, it were queer."
I stared at her, struck for a moment by the similarity between her words and Caroline's description of the mysteriously ringing phone. She met my gaze and shuddered. She said she had stuck the whistle hastily back in its socket and run from the room to fetch Betty, and Betty, after nerving herself up to it, had put her own ear to the mouthpiece and had also had the feeling of something queer being in the tube. That's when they had gone upstairs to complain about the business to the Ayreses. They had found Caroline alone and told her everything that had happened. She must have been struck by Mrs. Baseless' words, too. She listened carefully to their story, then accompanied them back to the kitchen and gingerly listened at the tube herself, but she heard nothing. Nothing at all. She said they must have been imagining things, or that the whistles were caused by the wind playing tricks. She hung a tea-cloth over the mouthpiece and told them that if the noise were to start again, they must simply ignore it. And she added, as an afterthought, that she hoped they would say nothing of this new nuisance to Mrs. Ayres. Her visit didn't do much to reassure them. In fact, the tea-cloth seemed only to make things worse, for now the speaking tube became like a parrot in a cage. Every time they found themselves starting to forget about it and to sink back into their old routines, it would let out one of its awful whistles and frighten them to death. In any other setting, such a story would have struck me as farcical. But the hall, by now, had a disconcertingly palpable air of stress, of tension. The women in it were tired and nervous, and I could see that Mrs. Baseley's fear, at least, was very real. When she'd finished speaking, I left her side and went across the kitchen to look at the speaking tube myself. Lifting the tea-cloth, I found a bland ivory cup and whistle fixed to the wall at head height on a shallow wooden mount. A less sinister-looking thing it would have been hard to imagine. And yet, when I thought of the disquiet it had managed to inspire, the very quaintness of the object before me began to seem slightly grotesque. I was reminded uneasily of Roderick. I remembered those ordinary things, the collar, the cufflinks, the shaving mirror, which had seemed in his delusion to come to crafty, malevolent life. Then, as I drew the whistle free, another thought struck me. This was a nursery servant's speaking tube. My mother had been nursery maid here. She must have spoken many times into this device 40 years before. The thought caught me off guard. I had the sudden irrational idea that, in putting my ear to the cup, I would hear my mother's voice. I had the idea that I'd hear her calling my name, exactly as I used to hear her calling me home at the end of the day, when I was a boy playing out in the fields at the back of our house. I became aware of Mrs. Baseley and Betty watching, perhaps beginning to wonder at my delay. I dipped my head to the mouthpiece. And, like Caroline, I heard nothing, only the faint surge and echo of the blood in my ear, sounds which, I suppose, might easily have been translated by an overwrought imagination into something more sinister. Straightening up, I laughed at myself. "I think Miss Caroline had the right idea," I said. "This tube must be 60 years old at least. The rubber must be perished. The wind gets in and makes those whistles. I dare say it's the wind that's been setting the bells off, too." Mrs. Baseley looked unconvinced. She said, with a glance at Betty,
"I dunno, doctor. This child's been saying for months that the house has something queer about it. Suppose—"
"This house is falling apart," I said firmly. "That's the sad truth, and all there is to it." And to put a stop to the whole business, I did what Mrs. Baseley or Caroline, if they had been less distracted, might easily have done for themselves. I tugged the ivory whistle from its chain and put it in my waistcoat pocket, and I replaced it with a cork. I assumed that would be the end of the matter, and for several days, I believe, there was calm in the house. But then on the following Saturday morning, Mrs. Baseley came into the kitchen as usual and noticed that the tea-cloth, which she had hung back over the speaking tube after my visit, and which had remained there undisturbed since then, had somehow fallen to the floor. She supposed that Betty must have knocked it, or a breeze from the passage dislodged it, so with shrinking fingers she picked it up and put it back in place. An hour later she noticed that the cloth had fallen again. By now Betty was with her, having come down from her duties upstairs. She picked up the cloth and returned it to the mouthpiece, taking care, she told me earnestly, to tuck it tightly into the crack between the wooden mount and the wall. Again the cloth came free, and this time Mrs. Baisley actually caught a glimpse of it falling. She saw it from the corner of her eye as she stood at the kitchen table. She said it didn't flutter, as if caught by a breeze. Instead, it slid straight down to the floor, as if someone had tugged it. By now she was tired of her own fear, and the sight exasperated her. She caught the cloth up and flung it aside, then stood squarely before the stopped-up tube and shook her fist at it.
"Go on!" she cried. "You hateful old thing! No one's minding you! Do you hear me?"
She put a hand on Betty's shoulder.
"Don't look at him, Betty. Come away. If he wants to go on pranking, let him try. I'm sick to death of him."
And she turned on her heel and headed back to the table. She had taken only two or three steps when she heard the sound of something softly striking the kitchen floor. She turned back to see that the cork, which a week before she had watched me screw snugly into the ivory mouthpiece, had been plucked or pushed from its socket and was rolling around at her feet. At that, all her bravado left her. She gave a scream and darted to Betty, who had also heard the cork fall, although she hadn't seen it rolling, and the two of them ran from the room, banging the door closed behind them. They stood for a moment in the vaulted basement passage, almost frightened out of their wits. Then, hearing movement on the floor above, they stumbled together up the stairs. They were hoping for Caroline, and I wish now that they had found her. I think she would have been able to calm them down and keep the matter in check. But Caroline, unfortunately, was down at the building work with Bab. It was Mrs. Ayres they met, just coming out of the little parlour. She had been sitting quietly reading, and, taken by surprise by them now, she imagined from the wildness of their manner that some new catastrophe had taken place, another fire broken out, perhaps. She knew nothing of the whistling speaking tube, and when she finally pieced together their confused account of the falling tea towel and the tumbling cork, she was nonplussed.
"But what has frightened you so much?" she asked them.
They couldn't properly say. All she could understand finally was how shaken they both were. The thing didn't strike her as very serious, but she agreed to go and take a look. It was rather a nuisance, she said, but then the house was full of nuisances these days. They followed her down to the threshold of the kitchen, but further than that they would not go. When she went in, they stayed at the door, clutching at the frame, and watching in dismay as, bemused, she examined the lifeless cloth, the cork, and the now silent tube. And when she delicately tucked back her loops of greying hair and lowered her head to the mouthpiece, they stretched out their arms and said,
"Oh, madam, be careful! Oh, madam, do please take care!"
Mrs. Ayres hesitated just for a moment, struck, perhaps, as I had been a few days before, by the sincerity of fear in their voices. Then she carefully put her ear to the cup and listened. When she straightened up, her expression was almost apologetic.
"I'm afraid I don't quite know what I ought to have heard. There seems to be nothing."
"There's nothing there now," said Mrs. Baisley. "But it'll be back, madam. It's in there, waiting."
"Waiting? But what do you mean? You talk as though there's a sort of genie. How could there be anything there? The tube runs right up to the nurseries."
And here, Mrs. Baisley told me later, Mrs. Ayres stumbled, and her look changed. She said, more slowly,
"Those rooms are shut up. They've been shut up since the soldiers left us."
Now Betty spoke, in a voice of horror.
"Oh, madam, you don't suppose... You don't suppose summat's got up there, and is up there now?"
"Oh, my lord," cried Mrs. Baisley, "the girl's right. With them rooms all shut and dark like that, how do we know what's been going on in them? Anything could have been going on. Oh, why don't you call for Dr. Faraday and make him go up and have a look? Or let Betty run and fetch Makins, or Mr. Bab."
"Makins or Bab?"
said Mrs. Ayres, coming back to herself. "No, I certainly shan't. Miss Caroline will be home soon, and what she'll make of this I can't imagine. If you'll just get on with your tasks."
"We can't put our minds to housework, madam, with that nasty thing a-watching us."
"Watching you? A minute ago it only had ears."
"Well, whatever he've got, he ain't normal. He ain't nice. Or at least let Miss Caroline go up and take a look when she comes back. Miss Caroline won't stand for no nonsense."
But just as Caroline herself a week before had tried to keep her mother from being drawn into this matter, so now it occurred to Mrs. Ayres that she might very easily sort this out before her daughter's return. Whether she had any other motive in mind, I don't know. I think it likely that she did, that having just glimpsed the first faint thread of a particular idea, she felt almost compelled to pursue it. Anyway, much to Mrs. Baisley's and Betty's horror, she declared that she would put an end to the whole business by going upstairs and examining the empty rooms herself. So once again they followed her, this time up through the north passage to the hall, and just as they had stuck at the threshold of the kitchen, so now, at the foot of the staircase, they hung fearfully back, clutching at the serpent-headed banister, and watched her climb. She went briskly and almost silently in her indoor shoes, and once she had rounded the first landing, all they could do was put back their heads and lean into the stairwell to watch her go higher. But they saw the flash of her stockinged legs between the graceful, rising balusters, and the grip and slide of her ringed fingers on the mahogany rail. They saw her, high up on the second floor, pause and give a single glance back down at them. And then she moved off, over creaking boards. The creaks continued to sound after her footsteps faded, but at length even they died away. Mrs. Baisley overcame her fear enough to advance a little higher. Further than the first landing, however, nothing would induce her to go. She kept hard at the banister, straining her ears, trying to pick out sounds in the hundred's silence, like trying to spy figures in a mist. Mrs. Ayres, too, as she left the stairwell behind, was aware of the thickening silence. She was not afraid of it, she told me later, but something of Mrs. Baisley's and Betty's suspense must have infected her, even if ever so slightly, for though she had started up the staircase boldly enough, she now found herself moving more cautiously. This floor was laid out differently from the two floors below, with narrower corridors and noticeably lower ceilings. The dome of glass in the roof lit up the stairwell with a chill, milky light, but as in the hall downstairs, this had the effect of filling the spaces to every side of it with shadows. The rooms Mrs. Ayres had to pass on her journey to the nurseries were mostly box rooms or servants' bedrooms, and had long lain empty. Their doors were shut to prevent draughts, and some had been made fast in their frames with rolls of paper or chips of wood. This meant that the corridor was gloomier than ever, and with the generator off, the electric light switches were useless. So she moved on through the shadows until she reached the nursery passage, where she found the door to the day nursery closed, like all the others, with a key turned in its lock. It was as she put her hand to the key that she experienced the first touch of real apprehension, conscious again of the heavy hundred's silence, and suddenly irrationally fearful of what she might find when the door was opened. She felt almost too vividly the stir of old emotions. She remembered coming here, quietly, like this, to visit her children when they were small. She recalled odd scenes, Roderick running into her arms, clinging to her like a monkey, putting his wet mouth to her gown. Caroline, polite, standoffish, busy with paints, her hair falling forward into the colours. And then, as if from a different, distant era, she saw Susan in a creaseless dress. She remembered her nurse, Nurse Palmer. Rather sharp, rather stern, always giving the impression that one's visits were a trouble, as if one wanted to see one's child more than was really proper or nice. Unlocking the door, Mrs. Ayres half expected to hear her voice, half expected to find everything unchanged.
"Here's Mummy come up for you again. Look, Susan. Why, Mummy can't keep away."
But the room in which she found herself could not, after all, have been more anonymous nor more dismal. It had, as I've said, been stripped of its nursery furniture and fittings years before, and it now had the plangent, echoing quality of all bare, neglected rooms. Its floorboards were dusty, and the faded paper on its walls was stained with damp. A set of blackout curtains, streaked indigo by the sun, still hung from a wire at the barred sash windows. The old-fashioned hob hearth was swept, but the brass fender was spotted with smuts, where rainwater had found its way down the chimney. A corner of the mantelpiece was broken and showed pale as the exposed enamel on a freshly chipped tooth, but there on the chimney breast, just as Mrs. Ayres remembered, was the speaking tube. It finished on this floor, in a short length of braided pipe, with another tarnished mouthpiece at its end. She went across to it, lifted it, and took out its whistle, and it at once gave off a musty, unpleasant odour. Something like bad breath, she said, so that as she put the cup to her ear she was uncomfortably aware of all the lips which over the years must have pressed and slid against it. As before, she heard nothing save the muffled roar of her own blood. She listened for almost a minute, trying the mouthpiece at different angles against her ear. Then she fitted the whistle back in its socket, let the tube fall, and wiped her hands. She was disappointed, she realized. Quite horribly disappointed. Nothing about the room seemed to want or welcome her. She gazed around, trying to find a trace of the nursery life that had gone on in it. But there was no sign of the sentimental pictures that had used to hang on the walls, or anything like that. There were only grubby echoes of the soldier's occupation, rings and scratches and cigarette burns, scuffs on the skirting boards, and the window sills, as she found when she crossed to one of them, were ugly with little grey circles of gum. It was bitterly cold there, before the ill-fitting window sashes, but she stood for a moment, gazing at the view across the park, mildly intrigued by the high, oblique perspective it gave her on the far-off building work, and able, presently, to pick out the figure of Caroline, who was just beginning her journey back to the house. The sight of her tall, eccentric-looking daughter making her solitary way across the fields made Mrs. Ayres feel bleaker than ever, and after a moment of watching she stepped back from the glass. To her left was another door, communicating with a neighbouring room, the old night nursery. That was the room in which her first daughter had lain sick with diphtheria. The place, in fact, where she had died. The door was ajar. Mrs. Ayres found she couldn't resist the dark temptation to open it properly and go inside. But again, there was little here that she remembered, nothing but wear and waste and neglect. A couple of panes in the windows were cracked, the sash frame crumbling around them. A corner hand-basin gave off a sour, uriny smell, and the boards beneath were almost rotting where a leaking tap had dripped. She went across to examine the damage. Leaning, she put a hand to the wall. The wallpaper had a raised pattern of loops and arabesques that had once, she recalled suddenly, been very colourful. It had been painted over with a drab distemper, which the damp was turning to a sort of curd. She looked at the stains on her fingers with a feeling of distaste, then stood and worked her hands together trying to brush the distemper from her skin. She was sorry now that she'd come in here, sorry that she'd come up to these rooms at all. She went to the basin and ran some frigid, spluttering water over her hands. She wiped her fingers against her skirt and turned to leave. And as she did that, she felt the starting up of a breeze. Or, anyway, something like a breeze, a cold movement of air, which came suddenly against her, striking her cheek, disarranging her hair, making her shiver. And a second later she was shocked and jolted almost out of her skin by a violent slamming in the neighbouring room. She guessed pretty much at once what had happened, that the door she'd unlocked and left open had been swung to by a draught from the badly fitting windows. But still, the sound was so unexpected and so sickeningly loud in the stripped, silent room, it took her a moment to recover herself and steady her lurching heart. Trembling slightly, she went back through to the day nursery, and, as she'd expected, its door was closed. She crossed to it and caught hold of its handle, and couldn't open it. She stood still for a second, perplexed. She turned the handle to left and to right, supposing in dismay that the spindle must have broken, thinking that the violence with which the door had blown shut must have jolted the mechanism. But the lock was the old rim kind, fitted to the door and painted over. There was a slight gap between it and its keep, as there usually is, and when she stooped and put her eye to this, she could see very clearly that the spindle was working as it should, and that the bolt of the lock had been shot home, just as if the key on the other side had been deliberately turned. Could a breeze have done that? Could a slamming door have locked itself? Surely not. She grew a little uneasy. She went back through to the night nursery to try the door there. That was locked, too, but then there was no reason to expect to find it otherwise. It was locked fast, like all the others on this floor, against the cold. So she returned to the first door to try it again, struggling now to hold on to her patience and her nerve, reasoning with herself that the wretched thing could not be locked, that it must simply be warped, as lots of hundreds doors were warped and sticking in its frame. But the door had moved easily enough when she had first opened it, and when she peered again into the gap between the lock and the keep, she again saw the shot bolt, unmistakable even in the gloom. Putting her eye to the keyhole, she could even make out the rounded end of the shaft of the turned key. She tried to see if there were some way she might get at that, perhaps with a hairpin, and work it back. She still supposed that the door had managed in some extraordinary way to lock itself. Then she heard something. Quite distinct, through the silence, it rose. The swift, soft patter of footsteps. And in the inch of murky, milky light which showed at the keyhole, she saw a movement. It came, she said, like a flash of darkness, as of someone or something passing very rapidly along the corridor, from left to right. In other words, as if heading along the nursery passage from the back stairs at the northwest corner of the house. Since she supposed, reasonably enough, that the person could only be Mrs. Baisley or Betty, her first response was one of relief. She got to her feet and tapped on the door.
"Who's there?" she called. "Mrs. Baisley? Betty? Betty, is it you? Whoever you are, you've locked me in, or someone has."
She rattled the handle.
"Hi! Do you hear me?"
Bafflingly, no one answered. No one came. And the footsteps faded. Mrs. Ayres lowered herself back down before the keyhole, and again looked out, until at last, and again, to her considerable relief, the pattering returned and drew nearer.
"Betty?"
she called, for she realized now that the footsteps, so rapid and soft, could hardly belong to Mrs. Baisley.
"Betty, let me out, child. Can't you hear me? Can't you see the key? Come and turn it, can't you?"
But, much to her bewilderment, there came only another flash of darkness, moving from right to left this time, and instead of pausing at the door, the footsteps went on.
"Betty!"
she called again, more shrilly. A moment of silence. Then the footsteps returned. And after that, the quick, dark figure passed and repassed the door, again and again. She could see the blur of it as it ran. It moved like a shadow, without face or feature. All she could think, with growing horror, was that the figure must be Betty's after all, but that the girl had somehow lost her wits, and was racing up and down the nursery passage like a lunatic. But then, the next time it came, the pattering figure seemed to draw closer to the door, seemed to brush against it with an elbow or a hand, and the times after that, the pattering footsteps were accompanied by a light sort of grating sound. Mrs. Ayres understood suddenly that, as it ran, the figure was catching at the panels of wood with its fingernails. She had a distinct impression of a small, sharp-fingered hand. A child's hand, she realized it was, and the thought was such a startling one she scrambled back from the door in sudden panic, tearing her stockings at the knee. She got to her feet in the center of the room, chilled and shaking. At that, at their loudest point, the footsteps abruptly ceased. She knew now that the figure must be standing on the other side of the door. She even saw the door move a little in its frame, as if just nudged or pressed or tested. She looked at the lock, expecting to hear the turning of the key and see the twisting of the handle, and nerving herself for what would be revealed when the door was opened. But after a long moment of suspense, the door relaxed back on its hinges. She held her breath, until all she could hear, as if on the surface of the silence, was the rapid thumping of her own heartbeats. Then, from over her shoulder, there came a sudden piercing blast from the whistle of the speaking tube. So unexpected was the sound, and so completely had she been bracing herself for some quite different shock, she started away from the ivory mouthpiece, crying out and almost stumbling. The tube fell silent, then whistled again. The whistle after that came regularly, a series of shrill, prolonged blasts. It was impossible, she said, to suppose that the sound might be the product of a breeze or a freak of acoustics. The whistle was purposeful, demanding, something like the wail of a siren or the cry of a hungry baby. It was so deliberate a signal, in fact, that the thought at last broke through her panic that there might, after all, be a simple enough explanation, for wasn't it possible that Mrs. Baisley, anxious for her safety but still unwilling to follow her upstairs, had returned to the kitchen and was trying to communicate with her? The tube, anyway, was at least a part of the ordinary human hundreds world, nothing like that inexplicable pattering figure out in the passage. So, again, screwing up her courage, Mrs. Ayres went to the chimney-breast and picked the shrieking thing up. With clumsy, shaking fingers, she drew the ivory whistle from it, and was instantly, of course, plunged back into silence. But the thing in her hand was not quite silent after all. As she raised the cup to her ear, she could hear, coming from it, a faint, moist susurration, as if wet silk or something fine like that were being slowly and haltingly drawn through the tube.
The sound, she realized with a shock, was that of a laboured breath, which kept